From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today, sculptor Andy Goldsworthy talks about his ephemeral outdoor art.
I cannot just work with stone or the more permanent materials. I need to work with leaves and ice and snow and mud and clay and water and the rising tide and the wind.
Much of Goldsworthy's work is created in the fields and forests near his home in Scotland.
Most of the works are seen by farmers, you know, who come across me working.
Working with nature, he's had stones collapse on him, he's gotten all scratched up, been bitten by insects, but...
I haven't been bitten by a snake yet, and I haven't had a scorpion bite, but considering what I've done in life, I've come away thus far relatively unscathed.
Goldsworthy's ephemeral works are documented in a new book of photos. Also today, John Powers reviews a new novel set in the Congo. That's on Fresh Air. Before we get back to Fresh Air, let me tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, NPR's Planet Money. It's full of funny, insightful stories about how the world works, like how Price Club and its imitators made shopping harder and why customers loved it. Plus, useful stuff like the inside story behind the resurrection of the Hydrox cookie. You can find Planet Money at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app. Imagine walking through the woods and finding what looks like a giant spiderweb fashioned of twigs hanging from a tree, or a stone wall with a large row of sheets of ice stood on end across the top of the wall, or a dead tree dusted with chalk, giving the tree a ghostly appearance. These natural yet unnatural forms are both beautiful and unsettling. They're examples of my guest Andy Goldsworthy's art. His materials include stone, grass, leaves, ice, trees, rivers, streams. His art is partly formed and changed by the weather, time, and decay. And since some of the work can melt, blow away, get washed away, or collapse, photographic documentation is essential. That's the only way most of us will ever get to see his ephemeral work. A new book collects photos of his ephemeral works from 2004 to 2014. Goldsworthy has also made temporary museum installations at the Getty in Los Angeles and the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York. He lives in Scotland. Andy Goldsworthy, welcome to Fresh Air. I think of you as using things that occur in the natural world, using that as your raw material, whether it's like, you know, leaves or stone or ice or twigs, but using these naturally occurring things in ways that don't quite look natural. So, is that fair?
Well, the things that I make are that which a person will make. They're not meant to mimic nature. They are nothing but the result of the hand of a person. So, they are about the human nature and the human touch and involvement with the world around me. And the intention is, as I said, not to mimic nature, but to understand it.
What you do definitely seems to have an element of obsession on a basic level, like gathering leaves that are the exact same shade of yellow so that you can design with them, like arrange them in a certain way or almost paint with them in a certain way, or collecting the right number of rocks of a certain shape that you need to build something, or putting pieces of ice together so like icicles suddenly take on a spiraling shape instead of the shape that they naturally had. This work really requires obsession. Do you agree with that?
I can get pretty. I get very determined. Mm-hmm. The process is not one that I feel is one of design. I mean, design implies a sense of mapping something out, and then you follow the plan. You know, these things grow, and the process of making is parallels that of growth. And so in the making of a work, layer by layer, stone by stone, branch by branch, leaf by leaf, petal by petal, one being added to the next, you are something grows in front of me. And the process of growth is obviously critical to my understanding of the land and myself. So the process is far more unpredictable, with far more compromises with the with the day, the weather, the material. You know, this isn't paint out of a pot or materials from a lumber yard or a stone yard. These come raw from the ground and have all the irregularities and peculiarities that because of that. And with that comes a resistance. There's always this tension and overcoming of problems and difficulties. And this last week I've been rather unusually, maybe sort of obsessed with just one particular work, and I've worked on it for a week, and it's in the stump of a fallen oak tree, which I've tried to build a dry stone wall in the side of, and it's about 9 feet high. And so far I've only reached about 7 feet. That's the latest before it collapsed, and it's now is still standing in Scotland, or not standing. Part of it is standing in a pile of its own debris, waiting for me to return. So it's that's a process of stone by stone, getting to understand the stone a little better each time and getting a little higher each time, and then these inevitable collapses. And it might be that I never succeed with that work.
But so you're building a stone wall in a decaying tree trunk?
Yeah. Well, it's like half the trunk still remains, or two-thirds of it does, up to about 10 feet. And so I'm filling where the tree used to be with stone. And as you can imagine, the pressure of the stone gets greater as I build the work higher. So the stronger visually the work gets, the actually closer it gets to its collapse. So it's actually getting weaker as it's getting stronger. And there's this wonderful tensions that occur during that process. And it can be desperately upsetting when it collapses after doing all of that work. And then I just have to begin again.
But are you documenting it every step of the way in case it does collapse?
No, I keep the documentation generally to the after the work. Photographing the works requires a different kind of approach, and I don't have that head on when I'm making the works. But having said that, this particular piece, after it's fallen down now three times, so it's 3 days, three collapses, the actual act of collapse and the attempt is becoming interesting enough to become the work. And I may have bitten off something I cannot make here, and I don't know if I will be able to achieve what I want to, or I will with a huge amount of luck and chance. But if I don't, I think that act of building and rebuilding, building, rebuilding, collapse, and could become the work. The danger in that, how can I put this? I mean, failure is really, really important. But failures have to hurt. And if I start making this work with the intention that it's collapsing, then I've lost that intensity of the will for it to succeed, which makes the failure that much more poignant and significant. So there's a really odd sort of state of mind that I guess I get into when I'm making these works is necessary for me to extract the finished piece, but also extract the right kind of feeling for the work as I'm making it.
So this work becomes like a paradox of, like, you want to succeed, but you're really interested in the failure, but you can't want the failure too much because then the failure becomes the success. It becomes ridiculous.
No, it really does. The whole thing, and, you know, people don't understand. I don't think they understand that about the work. They just collapse and fall, and that this is, you know, what I accept. Well, I can't, to achieve what I want, to achieve the works that I make, I have to be fully committed to them succeeding. I couldn't make them otherwise. And you cannot feel that commitment without feeling or having a deep sense of loss when they do collapse or fail.
So
that's inevitable.
So with this particular work, could you explain, like, do you have a rational explanation for why you even want to build a very tall stone wall inside a decaying tree trunk?
Well, the trunk itself is such an interesting form. And, you know, I knew the tree when it grew, and the tree is now gone. The farmers cut it up and it's become firewood. And there's this tremendous sense of absence and shock and violence attendant to that collapsing tree. You know, if you've ever come across a tree that you've lived with for many years and then one day it's blown over, there's incredible shock and violence about that. And I worked with the tree when it was collapsed, before it was chopped up on the ground, and now I'm just left with this stump, this space. which I want to also understand this space. And I made a work previously in the trunk with branches, so I completed this void, this negative area with branches. And there will often be this dialogue between wood, stone, so the process of laying branches layer by layer, then stone, stone by stone, the sort of geological growth connections that I really quite enjoy exploring. And whilst it is a challenging work to make, I am learning so much about that tree, those stones. And even the stones that I'm using are from piles deposited at the side of the field by farmers over many, many years when they've ploughed the fields. So they've already got the hand of a person on the stones before I've even come to them. And the whole process of agriculture that produced these stones is somehow part of this, you know, the cycle of the field and the cycle of growth and the cycle of decay that this tree has gone through. So it's much, much, much broader than just a stone in my hand. And that's why I work outside. I work with the stones that have this lineage in the place. The tree also has its lineage. And by working with it, I go way beyond just the wood and stone, but to the process of growth and farming and the tensions between the two.
So the work that you've been describing, it has something that's pretty indomitable, stone, very lasting, something that lives a long time but eventually dies and decays, the tree. You're interested in growth. You're also interested in decay. And you have one piece that you've documented in your new book, Ephemeral Works, of a hole that you've dug and molded out of the rotted heartwood of a fallen tree. I'm not sure what rotted heartwood is, but that's what it says on the on the piece.
Rotten heart. Yeah.
So anyways, what you're saying is this, like, part of a rotted tree with this, like, perfect circular hole in it, this perfect circular void in it. And you've said looking into a dark hole unnerves you. So what is it about holes that interest you, particularly like holes in something big and organic like a tree?
Well, I think that I'm always trying to get beyond the surface appearance of things, to go beyond what I can just see. And I think that's one of the reasons why there's many cracks, fissures, openings, holes that have appeared in the work over time. Generally speaking, I make less holes now than I used to. I think there is always dangers for artists that they get a particular form and then it becomes this motif that reappears because it's a motif, and that's a big danger, you know. But the one that you're talking about is a fairly recent work, and it's a big ash tree that fell. It's near to where I live, another tree that I've lived with for many years. And it fell because it was rotten inside, you know. And when it fell, I went to the tree and I put my hand into its innards, you know, and put my hand, it's soft and wet and rotten inside, you know. And that was like the heartwood of the tree had died. And I think there is this connection between the black of a hole and the absence of things. And I guess that's where words stop, you know.
The circle, the circular hole is a perfect circle. I doubt it occurred naturally as so perfect a circle.
Well, I formed the circle. You know, I gouged out the rotten wood with my hand. So that shows just how rotten it was. I mean, it wasn't easy, but I could, you know, a lot of it was very wet and moist. And it was really like organs, you know, of a body. And so I dug out that and then formed the edge of the hole with the rotten wood. And the darkness of the hole is achieved by making a very thin, fine edge that cuts the light into dark and light. So it is a constructed hole in that tree.
Can I say that making this sound, like, oddly sexual?
Was it really? I have no idea. I think that, you know, It's a very sensual, yeah, yeah, maybe sexual. Yeah, no, I feel my art is fed by every emotion and feeling that I have.
So is all this happening on your own land?
No, well, that particular tree was growing on the boundary. I have 6 acres in front of my own house, which I very rarely work on. Most of the work occurs on farmers' fields around me. And I like the discipline of working on other people's land. I think that that's not some sort of hippie ideal. It's just that when I work on someone else's land, it makes me aware of the social nature of that landscape. And Britain is a landscape that's been fashioned over thousands of years and has a strong social nature to it. And it makes me aware of the farmer's touch and the people who pass through that landscape. And many of the works, most of the works are seen by farmers, you know, who come across me working.
You just did the hippie disclaimer that this wasn't like a hippie thing. Did you feel the need to say that because you think people project onto your work things that you aren't interested in and don't see there yourself?
Yes, I think probably. And there is a sort of a tendency to sort of romanticize work like mine as a lone figure in the landscape out there communing with nature and floating around and making these things with leaves and petals. Whereas it's actually a really vigorous and intense physical and practically based process.
I'm wondering about the injuries you may have gotten over the years from lifting stone, from working with ice, from breaking twigs, from insects that might have interfered with your work. So I'm wondering, have you gotten any of these things in this little list that I made? Poison ivy and other rashes, back injuries from lifting heavy stones, hurt feet from stones dropping on your feet after one of your sculptures collapsed, slipping on the ice while you're in the Arctic making ice sculptures, weird insect bites. I know you've scratched your skin because you do have a documentation of that in your new book. And it's of like various photographs of just close-ups of your skin with scratches and just like a little bit of bright red blood kind of, covering up some of the hairs on your skin. So have you gotten all of those injuries and more?
Oh, yeah. All of the above. I haven't been bitten by a snake yet and I haven't had a scorpion bite, but it's a very physical process.
You must have had frostbite over the years too, working with ice.
I've never actually had frostbite. I've had skin peeling off me in places that got pretty close to it. But considering what I've done in life, I've come away thus far relatively unscathed.
Good. You work with ice a lot. You live in Scotland where it can get very cold in the winter. You've traveled to the Arctic to work with ice. And one of the things you do is take icicles and refashion them. Like you break the icicles into bits and fashion them into spirals or other shapes that wouldn't occur in a naturally forming icicle. Can you talk a little bit about your fascination with ice and with ice as a material for you to use?
Well, I love the winter. Well, I love all the seasons, but the winter is possibly one of the most intense. And the British climate, although it is very wet, it is quite mild in winter. We don't get these generally don't get severe winters. And when it does get below freezing and there is it's cold enough for ice to form, then that changes the whole landscape and it makes the landscape a different landscape to the one that I've worked with previously. And I want to understand that. But the big tension of the ice works is that they're often made when it's cold enough to freeze one piece of ice to another. And the temperature very rarely stays below freezing all day long in Britain. So I typically will get up very, very early when it's dark and I'll start working in the dark, which can be difficult because I can't really see what I'm doing. And I can work very, very quickly whilst it's freezing. And then the temperature starts to rise and the work slows down. And then if it stops freezing, the work collapses. But if I can get through the midday period, and I often try to find places where the sun can't reach so I can work in the cold shadow of a sunny day. And if I can get through the midday, then I can work through to the evening, afternoon, and then in those very rare occasions, there'll be 2 or 3 days of continuous freezing, and then I can continue to add to the works. Or latterly, even leave the works for the flowing of waters to start covering the work up so they become embedded in frozen ice, so the process continues. So there's a huge number of things that are occurring with the ice works which fascinate me enormously, but it's driven by this kind of frantic race against time. And whilst that creates a huge amount of tension and problems, it's a tension that I think I feed off. You know, on those times when I have been to places where it's been constantly cold, the luxury of having constantly sub-zero temperatures is amazing. It's really wonderful, and I enjoy that. But I wouldn't like that all the time. I think I have been fashioned by the fickle weather of Britain, that it's forever changing. There's no kind of constant sun or dry weather or freezing weather. And I'm always having to change and adapt to that. And I think that brings a sort of energy to the work that I might not have if I worked in another place.
My guest is sculptor Andy Goldsworthy. He has a new book of photographs of his ephemeral works from 2004 to 2014. After we take a short break, we'll talk about making rain shadows. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for this episode of Fresh Air comes from Citrix GoToMeeting, connecting people and businesses in face-to-face online meetings. They want you to know that with Citrix GoToMeeting, you can collaborate and get work done even if your team is stuck at home. You can meet from any computer or mobile device, share screens to collaborate in real time, and turn on webcams to see each other in HD video. Right now, Citrix is offering a 30-day free trial at gotomeeting.com. Click on the Try It Free button to get started.
When asked about why you do ephemeral work, you've said, well, you know, everything dies. And that's true, but there are great paintings and sculptures that have survived for centuries. I mean, art endures, or at least some art endures, much longer than any life, any individual life does, or that even certain civilizations have, you know, certain cultures have. So why pass up the opportunity for any kind of permanence and create works that are so ephemeral they're going to melt?
Well, it's not that I pass up on that opportunity, because there are works that I have made that will last many, many years with stone, Storm King Wall and many others. And it's not a stance against art or well-made art or long-lasting art. It's not about art. It's just about life and the need to understand that a lot of things in life do not last. And to understand the nature of things, I have to understand the nature of change. And I cannot just work with stone or the more permanent materials. I need to work with leaves and ice and snow and mud and clay and water and the rising tide and the wind and all this. I need to work with those to understand what's around me. And that's the reason for making those works. It is also important that the work does not just live in the form of photographs. So the work needs to, on occasions, be made in a place that people can engage with it. And the large-scale projects, it's like being two different artists in a way. You know, I have the ephemeral work and then I have the large-scale works where I will use machinery, cranes, tools, people. And they're made in a very, very different way. And there is, I suppose, the big difference between, one of the big differences, it's a simplification, but when I make an ephemeral work, when it's finished, that's the moment that it ends in a way. From there on, it melts, decays, and disappears. When I do the permanent projects, the big projects, when a work is finished, that's the beginning of its life. And they do look to the future in that respect, not as a vehicle for my work to last for posterity. They are about the future. And they depend, their life depends very much upon how people care for them, respond to them. They have a strong social nature to them. Not as people as an audience, but they are made in a landscape of which people are part of and are typically walls that can be walked alongside, chambers for people to step into, houses for people to enter, and most recently a wall that you can walk inside of. So people are bound up in those works. And without that relationship with people, then to give it life, to bring it to life, the works will not work. They will not be successful.
There's one other series I want to ask you about. You have a series of what you call rain shadows of your body. That's not an expression I've heard of before. Is that a word you made up, or am I the only one who doesn't know what a rain shadow is?
Well, that is one of, as has been one of my main obsessions. I'm getting a little out of it now, but for a while, if it rained, I just had to lay down.
Yeah, explain what a rain shadow is and how you make it.
Well, it's when it starts to rain, I lay down and
outside, not in your bed.
Oh yeah, no. Yes, no, these are outdoor works. So it rains, I lay down, or I find a surface quickly that I think will produce a good rain shadow, and I lay there. And when it's wet enough, I get up, and there is left behind me my imprint, my shadow. And that sounds really quite simple, but it is beautifully complex. What kind of rain? The length of time. Sometimes it stops raining when I'm halfway through. Sometimes I can lie there for an hour waiting for the rain. And other times it's over in 4 or 5 seconds. And I often do them on video. So you have the whole film of the laying down and then me getting up and leaving the shadow.
You've done some of these on a country road. And so it looks as if on a forensic investigation, they've outlined where the body was. It's kind of like that shape, but it's what you call a rain shadow. It's like your impression, or it's like a dry part of the road and everything else was wet and transformed by the water, so that you see the difference between the impression of your body and the road or the earth around it. If I came across that in the middle of the road, I would think, oh, there was a murder here. The police have been here and done, like, they chalked it off or something. Like, I wouldn't know what's going on. There's something really unsettling about it.
Well, it is. Yeah, the nature for me
Like if you told me this was a piece of art and I came across it, I'd say, oh, that's really beautiful. If I came across it not knowing what it was, I'd be concerned.
Yeah. Well, you should be. You know, nature for me is not this, it is raw and dangerous and difficult and beautiful and unnerving. It is so unnerving, you know. I've laid down in dried up stream beds, leaving a shadow, and then 5 minutes later, it's flash flooded, and where I once laid is now running water, which would have washed me away. You know, there's that power and danger often in places that look so calm and pastoral to begin with, you know, and then this violence erupts out of the place, which I think is quite extraordinary and very unnerving, but at the same time very beautiful.
What does it feel like lying on your back in the middle of a rainstorm?
Well, it depends where I am. And I have actually made them in New York, on the streets of New York too. You
know, You've got photos of that in the book too.
They're in the book, yeah, the Times Square one. I mean, laying down for 15 minutes in Times Square is a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not a performer in that I don't like the public, but I work in that respect. They're not being made as kind of theater. So they're very private acts in an incredibly public place. But how appropriate for the pavement, this surface that is ingrained with the passage of people. You know, that's what makes a city. People are the nature of the city, and you can feel it in the pavement. And we leave our presence in the pavement through walking up past, over it, sitting on steps. You know, you can feel where people have been before us. So the idea of laying down and leaving a momentary shadow there seems very much in the spirit of the city and the streets.
So when you were lying down in the rain in Times Square to create a rain shadow, was there somebody with a camera documenting the whole thing, making it clear that this was some kind of art thing? Or did people just pass you by and think, like, you were homeless or that maybe you were having, you know, that you were sick and they were going to ignore you anyways? Or did people come to your aid? Like, what? Anything can happen in Times Square.
Well, generally in New York, people just walk over you. Mm-hmm. No problem about that. Other countries, people want to resuscitate you, look after you. And of course, I can't move because I'll spoil the shadow. So I'm going to say, it's okay. I'm just making sure I'm making that. But I do have a camera. There's a camera on a tram, a movie, small, you know, cameras to video the work. And there'll be, I usually try and have someone who can look after that. But it's fairly low key. And it is, you know, I'm prone to people but it's only after, actually, when I see the video that I realize how much activity is going around me sometimes. You know, people laying down next to me, jumping over me. I sort of just concentrate on the rain. And I have learned so much about rain, you know, the different kinds of rains, the rhythms of rains. And you know, people will say, oh, why don't you just use a hose pipe, you know? But that would be totally pointless. You know, the point is not just to make the shadow, it's to understand the rain that falls and the relationship with rain and the different rhythms of different rainfalls.
Do you ever get sick afterwards?
No, not that I can remember. Although there was a rather wonderful New York policeman said, I remember her saying, do you know how many communicable diseases you could get by lying down there? And at times they were absolutely amazing. You know, they were protecting me at one point.
You went to art school. Did you at any point think that you were going to work with more traditional mediums, that you were going to work on a canvas or do sculptures, you know, more working with more traditional materials, things designed to be indoors or to indoor as outdoor sculptures made out of things like metal?
Well, I started working outside pretty early on. In fact, I have a show in New York in 3 weeks' time, which is new work to do with a lot of the kind of body things that I've been doing recently. But there are also some works from way back, and there's one from 1976 when I was 20. So I began fairly. It was almost as if it was when I began at art college, and it was you know, when you go to art school or at that time, it was, you know, you sort of have this idea that art is this means of self-expression, and you have a canvas or whatever, and you express yourself on this canvas. But you know, I don't think I'm that kind of artist that. And it's particularly at that age that had anything to say, you know. And it was just very difficult in a studio where you have a blank canvas and just yourself. And when I started working outside, I felt as if I was tapping into things that were important, we were alive and learning about things as opposed to trying to express something about that. And that was a big shift, and that's what has sustained me for 40 years, nearly 40 years.
When you were working on farms as a teenager, did you see the haystacks and the plowing, the shapes in the plowing of a field as being art then, you know, of being beautiful and of being, you know, just like beautiful patterns and shapes?
Well, I didn't see them as beautiful patterns because when you make or shapes, because when you're making these things, it's just really hard work, mm-hmm. and it's just hard. And I still see that. I know I don't, and that's their beauty, is that they're not just these beautiful. There's this kind of structural, practical integrity to them, which I still try to achieve in everything that I make. It's not an attempt to create some pastoral idyll. I mean, these are, if anything, what I do is a vigorous attempt to kind of counteract that idea of the landscape of being some idyll. And those works that I've made in fields, you know, fields for me are battlefields. And you see that particularly on the East Coast of America, where the old fields have been taken over by briars and trees, and how the farmer had to fight for that field. And so all fields are, in a sense, this forum for this fight that a farmer has to undergo to draw nourishment out of the ground. So it's always been this kind of rawness to the landscape that appeals to me. And I don't know if it appeals to me, but it's what it is. So I think those were really important. They felt like important subject matter.
How do you make a living? Do you sell the... Do you do commissions? Do you do installations? Is that how you make your living? Is it like photographs of the work? You can't sell an ice sculpture that's on like a public stream or lake or something.
The main source of my income is through the commissions of the large-scale works, the big sculptures, the projects. And the... this book that we have now, I mean, it's the first book I've made for 8 years. And I'm going to have an exhibition of some of the printed photographs in Gallery Lalong in New York in 2 or 3 weeks. And that's the first exhibition I've done of the photographs for a long, long time. So whilst they may become some source of revenue, they're certainly not done with that in mind, and nor are the large commissions. I would like to think that everything I'm making is being done because of my needs as an artist, but I am very grateful that it does provide an income for my life too. Don't get me wrong, I'm very fortunate to be able to do what I do and live the way I do.
So when you're looking for ideas or looking for materials, are you just kind of like walking through the world with an open mind, just looking for things? Or do you pretty much have an idea in mind and then find what you're looking for?
With the ephemeral work, it's very much an intuitive journey that starts with the day and the weather and depending what's happening. So it's a response to that day and what is seasonally or climatically around at the time. And the works are very much about light and atmosphere. And in the same way that I talked about the stone not just being a stone in my hand, but the connections it makes to the whole place. So... the work is the atmosphere of the day, the place, and it is driven in intuitively.
What are your neighbors who are farmers make of your work, and of you?
Well, I moved to Scotland 30 years ago. It's a small village, and I'm Scottish, not Scottish, I'm English, and I'm an artist and living in a small Scottish village. So one would expect to be treated with some sort of caution. And the village and the farmers have shown enormous tolerance of me and interest in what I do. I mean, they don't necessarily understand what I'm doing all the time, but I think they respect what I do, and that there is a connection between what they do with the land and what I do, you know, that we're both dependent on weather and respond to that. And, you know, there's been times, I remember one work where I was making a frost shadow. So these works are made, obviously, on a frosty day, and I stand in a field, and as the sun rises behind my back, shadow is cast onto the field in front of me, and as the sun burns off the frost around my shadow, the white shadow starts to come out of my black shadow, and then I step away, leaving this white shadow on the ground. Well, I stand there for about half an hour, three quarters of an hour, and I could hear the farmer in his quad going around looking after his sheep and whatever. He went up the hill, down the hill, over to his turnip field, and he He then drove past me and he knew I was up to something, but he had no idea what I'm doing. And he just said, "How are you doing, Andy?" and dropped me a couple of turnips by my feet and went on. And those turnips are in the photograph of the shadow that I made, you know. And it's that kind of just tolerance of me being there, standing in the field, doing something. He knows I was up to something, but, you know, whatever. It's fine. It's Andy.
Well, Andy Goldsworthy, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Andy Goldsworthy has a new book of photographs of his ephemeral works from 2004 to 2014. You can see a slideshow of his work on our website, freshair.npr.org. An exhibition of Goldsworthy photos opens October 22nd at the Gallery Le Long in New York City. Coming up, John Powers reviews a novel set in the scariest place John has ever been. This is Fresh Air. Before we get back to Fresh Air, let me tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, NPR's Planet Money. It's full of funny, insightful stories about how the world works, like how Price Club and its imitators made shopping harder and why customers loved it. Plus, useful stuff like the inside story behind the resurrection of the Hydrox cookie. You can find Planet Money at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app. The young African writer Fiston Mwanza Muzila won several international prizes for his debut novel Tram 83, a freewheeling tale about life in an imaginary city-state, clearly inspired by his home country, the Democratic Republic of Congo. An English translation of the book has just been released by Deep Vellum Publishing in Dallas. Our critic at large, John Powers, who once took a 24-day boat trip up the Congo River, says this book presents Central Africa from the inside.
If you ask me the scariest place I've ever been, I would instantly say the Democratic Republic of Congo, formerly Zaire, whose cruel past has led to a disastrous present. I'll never forget lying in my hotel bed and hearing the nightly machine gun fire on the nearby streets. And this was during peacetime, not during Congo's two largely ignored wars of the 1990s and early aughts that killed three times as many people as the current wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Syria combined. I've read a lot about Congo, but nearly always by outsiders. So I was excited to get my hands on Tram 83, an exuberantly dark first novel by Fiston Mwanza Muzila, a 34-year-old writer who was born in Lubumbashi, a teeming city in southeast Congo, but who now lives in Graz, Austria. Evoking everyone from Bruegel to Henry Miller to Céline, Fiston, as he's known, plunges us into a world so anarchic it would leave even Ted Cruz begging for more government. The hero is Lucien, a struggling writer fleeing the hinterlands. He arrives by train in an unnamed city-state run by a warlord, where foreigners come to pillage the mineral resources and exploited locals struggle to survive. If they're lucky, they eat dog meat kebabs. Lucien is met at the station by his old pal, nicknamed Requiem, who we quickly grasp is involved in some sort of dodgy business. Requiem takes Lucien to the city's true crossroads, a music-filled nightclub called Tram 83 that caters to immediate pleasure and boils with all manner of humanity. In this socially stratified African Weimar, you find tourists and greedy globalizers from the multinationals. You find weary miners, unpaid civil servants, and unemployed college grads. You find grifters and drug dealers and hookers, many of them so-called baby chicks, underage girls who, like everyone else, are just trying to keep alive. Where the cynical Requiem wallows in Tram 83, he has no interest in the past or the future, Lucien is a former history student who unnerves the club's denizens by constantly scribbling in notebooks and working on a progressive play to be produced in Paris. Fiston uses the pair's forays into society's underbelly to see which of their approaches to reality will win out. Will the amoral Requiem get his moral comeuppance? Or will the idealistic Lucien succumb to all the heaving flesh? Or given the inescapable chaos, does it even matter what individuals believe? Now I realize that Tram 83 may sound bleak, like those earlier classic novels about Congo, Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness, whose title says it all, and V.S. Naipaul's A Bend in the River, with its cheerless opening line, "The world is what it is." Certainly, Fiston has no doubts that Congo is what it is. It's a place where, as Requiem says, The mightier crush the mighty. The mighty defecate in the mouth of the weak. The weak sequestrate the weaker. The weaker do each other in, and then split for elsewhere. And yet the book's not a downer. When I traveled in Congo, I was always amazed by the vitality that shimmered through even the most downtrodden slums. Fiston captures that surging life force, too. If his portrait of Congo makes it appear socially and politically hopeless, what's hopeful is the spirit of his writing, which crackles and leaps with energy. Rather than moralize, he transfigures harsh reality with abounding inventive bebop-style prose, translated from the French with light-footed skill by Roland Glasser. Fiston evokes the textures of the city in all its deliriousness, blowing marvelous riffs on everything from the sleaziness of foreign visitors to the differing shapes of streetwalkers' buttocks to the way the poor patrons of Tram 83 like jazz, because it's so classy. Virtually every scene is punctuated by the come-ons of the prostitutes, too lewd to quote here, that serve almost like a Greek chorus, repeatedly saying, "Live for now, live for now, live for now." And are they right? Fiston thinks not. But he also pretty clearly doesn't see any way of living for the future in Congo, whose essence is embodied in Tram 83, where everything and everyone is for sale. The best you can do, his book suggests, is get the heck out of there, and then tell the world what you saw.
John Powers is film and TV critic for Vogue and Vogue.com. He reviewed Tram 83 by Fiston Mwanza Muzila. We want to correct a mistake in yesterday's review of Patti Smith's memoir, M-Train. Our book critic Maureen Carrigan said that there is no M-Train in New York. Listeners who live in New York and ride the M-Train know better. I want to remind you that our podcast is a great way to catch up on Fresh Air interviews you missed. You'll be able to listen when and where you want. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. I'm Terry Gross.